You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast, where we explore a huge range of crucial issues and exciting developments in the food industry with brilliant guests drawn from all areas of expertise. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a TV presenter and a writer specializing in food and science. And this podcast is part of our Smart Food series. And this focuses on the technologies trying to create efficiencies of scale and getting businesses working better together. We're very pleased to be joined by Daniel Hume, founder and CEO of Satalia. Hello, Daniel.
Hi, nice to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us. Can we just kick off with a very short lesson in AI, artificial intelligence? What is it and why does it matter?
Yes, so there are two definitions of AI. One, I think, is popular but weak, which is getting computers to do things that humans can do. Over the past decade, we've managed to get machines to do things that traditionally were only the domain of human beings, like recognizing objects and images, corresponding natural language, things that only humans used to be able to do. And because humans are the most intelligent thing we know in the universe, we then just assume that that's intelligence. Now, I would argue that it's not. It's just pattern recognition. And I tried to popularize a different definition of AI, which stems from the definition of intelligence. There's a very elegant definition of intelligence, which is goal-directed adaptive behavior. So goal-directed, in the sense you're trying to, I don't know, sell as many ice creams as possible to your customers, or you're trying to route your vehicles efficiently. You have to have a goal and objective. Behavior is how quickly you can move towards that goal. But the key word in this definition for me is adaptive. Ultimately, what you want to do is build systems that make decisions, learn about those decisions, are good or bad, and then adapt their own understanding of the world so they can make better decisions. And I haven't seen a single successful adaptive system in production in my life. So I will argue that nobody is doing AI.
And machine learning, is that the same thing? Are these two concepts interchangeable?
They are not, unfortunately. So machine learning is a set of technologies that are really good at finding patterns in data. And I guess we've seen over the past decade advances in machine learning, where we've got now machines to do things that humans can do. But ultimately, as I said, systems have to then make decisions based on those insights, which is a completely different set of skills. It's a set of skills that used to be called operations research. They are discrete mathematicians, they are logicians. It's skills that matured in academia about two decades ago, and then everybody got excited about machine learning. My prediction is that the companies have been hiring data scientists, they've been applying machine learning to problems that actually are optimization problems. So I would argue that companies don't have machine learning problems. They have optimization problems, they have decision problems. And then ultimately, you then need to be able to adapt based on those decisions that you're making, which for me is the true paradigm of AI. So machine learning is just a small component into the bigger AI architecture.
And then what's really interesting, I think, is that your expertise both spans sort of philosophy and ethical issues around this as well as technology. But we'll get onto that in a minute, because I think the most important question that everyone is seeking the answer to really is this one. Is it true that 2001 A Space Odyssey is the best film about AI? And that in actual fact, AI with Jude Law is frankly a pile of stinking robo-manure. Is Space Odyssey the one?
Do you know, Space Odyssey is very interesting because it depicts essentially a superintelligence. These monoliths, these black hexagons that are populated across the universe, are there to try and stimulate intelligence across our universe, which is why the famous scene of the chimpanzee going from hitting something with a bone to using it as a tool is amazing. And so the idea is that our universe somehow created or spawned by a superintelligence for some reason. And we don't know what that reason is, but the hypothesis is actually we're living in a simulation created by a superintelligence in a different universe.
You're messing with my mind now. And to try and work out the true nature of your personality, is Hal evil?
I think that, like all technologies can be used for good or bad. Hal had an objective. Hal had an objective function, which is to ensure survivability of the species or the human. And so, by taking the rights and the power away from that human being, what they were doing is protecting it from itself. And I think this is the risk that we pose with AI. If we set the wrong objective function, if we set an objective function which is, say, for example, to eradicate cancer, the easiest way of eradicating cancer is to eradicate human beings. And so it's critical that we have the right objective function, but we give the system the right constraints so that they're not making bad decisions. And again, this is the realm of optimization. This is a realm of decision making, and it's crucially important that we start thinking in this way.
Yeah, beautifully done. Taking my pathetic question and turning it into something really, really intelligent. Now, let's ground ourselves now. How does AI relate to the food industry right now? Is it being used in the food industry, and what are the options for it to be used?
Of course. So if we split the problem into two parts. So the first part, as I said, machine learning is great at finding patterns in data. So it's great at being able to recognize whether fruit is ripe or bruised or whatever. It's great at recognizing objects so that they can use machines to then pick up those objects and pack those objects. So there's been a huge amount of advances in using machines to now starting to do things that traditionally humans can do. The second thing, which again for me is the most exciting thing, is then making decisions. And I guess where the food industry does have a great pedigree is that they understand that the heart of their industry are optimization problems. They are logistics problems, they're manufacturing problems. It's how do I allocate my resources in a way to achieve my goal? How do I route my vehicles? How do I optimize my manufacturing processes? How do I make sure that the warehouses stock to fulfill my customers? These are optimization problems, and the food industry has again a pedigree in this area, and so they start out from the right place. They start out by solving those problems and then using machine learning to then make the make you be able to make better decisions. Where I think every industry is a long, long way off from is being able to then adapt those systems in production. And I guess that's where Satalia really helps companies like Tesco and whatnot to solve those problems or build adaptive systems.
And I sense a sort of a frustration in there as well when you say that you know you can give people the information, but it's the adaptability. So what you're saying is that it's change within organizations is possibly the hardest part of AI, and that's not the AI bit. It's actually getting people to use the damn thing.
It's not necessarily just change within an organization, but let's say, for example, I've got a delivery solution that's delivering groceries to people across the UK. Now I use optimization to figure out how to allocate my vehicles to the right deliveries. But what I can do is I can use machine learning to predict how long is it going to take to deliver to this customer? How long is it going to take to drive from A to B? Is there going to be demand in this particular area that allows me to release a vehicle to go and do those deliveries? So we can use machine learning to profile customers and things like that. I guess where the adaptive component comes in, if I'm predicting that it's going to take 7 minutes to deliver to your house and it takes 12 minutes, and then tomorrow I predict 7 minutes, but it takes 12 minutes. Unless my system is adapting, it's not going to be able to get smarter. And at the moment, you don't see systems in production that are adapting to this changing world. In fact, there's a lot of talk around automation. Now, automation is great because you give it data, it makes a decision. You give it the same data, it makes exactly the same decision. But the definition of stupidity is doing the same thing over again and expecting a different answer. So for me, by definition, automation is stupid. And we can get a long way by automating things. But again, the true paradigm of AI is then allowing those systems to be able to adapt.
Okay. Now you started off giving us a bit of a case study there, and you've worked with Tesco's on delivery solutions, I guess. Can you give us a bit more of a deeper understanding of how a project like that unfolds? I guess first of all, you're looking at a problem or an issue that needs to be adapted or solved. But how in reality does it all work?
That's a good question. So like many industries, in the food industry, particularly in the grocery industry, they already have systems in place to be able to do deliveries or to be able to figure out how to optimize the stock of shelves and things like that. Tesco is a really interesting company. At the time when we started to engage with them, they brought quite a lot of people on from Amazon. And Amazon's attitude is, we need to own all the IP. We need to be able to have control over the things that are impactful to our business, and everything else we can outsource. And obviously delivery is hugely important to grocers and making sure that they own that customer experience. And like many organizations, they have to depend on third-party vendors, third-party companies that are providing software solutions that have been in the market for decades and decades and really haven't been invested in. And so Tesco, to their credit, said, look, we want to build this last mile delivery solution ourselves, and we want to own it ourselves. And of course, like many large organizations, it's very difficult to attract the level of talent to be able to build these solutions that are going to compete with systems that have had decades of investment. But they really kindly chose Satalia, and we, from a standing start, from zero code, built by combining these technologies that I've described, machine learning, optimization, taking the state of the art from academia, we built a last mile delivery solution that Tesco now claim is the best last mile delivery solution in the world. And what was really awesome about that project, it was the first time that Tesco had engaged with a startup in this way. It's the first time that they built something that was cloud native, that was built on the cloud, that could scale according to demand. So it's a really great, great case study. And we really worked as one team, and we still engage with Tesco working on other projects. And so we produced something that was really spectacular. And now we're looking at figuring out how to take that innovation and bring it to market.
But how does that actually work? How does it unfold? I mean, you've got your team of people, and do you literally send them out and they experience the issue that they're dealing with, and then go back to your office in Islington and start writing code?
That's right. I was on Tesco vans, going out there, engaging with customers, understanding the pain points that the drivers had, the things that they enjoy in their work, and all of this kind of stuff. Ultimately, it's an iterative process, right? We want to understand what is the problem that we're trying to solve, what is the objective that a company like Tesco is trying to achieve. In which case, obviously, they're trying to figure out how to get more stuff to more customers, reduce their carbon footprint. And just as an anecdote, Tesco saved 11.2 million miles last year on their deliveries, which was to the moon and back 23 times.
So
even small improvements in being able to optimize these solutions can have a massive impact. But you're absolutely right. We go away, we try to understand the problem, we then try and build a solution. We come back to the people who are experiencing it, who are using it. They tell us that it's wrong. We go away, we make it better, and we make it iterative. But I guess the crucial component here is that we, Satalia, approach these problems with no fear. So we don't assume that things are impossible. We start from what is the perfect solution in this space, and we look at academia, we look at the expertise around the globe, and try and mobilize that team to solve the problem that have never been solved before. So probably one of my most successful teams in Satalia is a group of, it was a much larger than six people, but there's six people now working across 60 different countries, building innovations for the likes of Tesco that don't need to be in the same room, but actually are able to work together in these new ways.
Perfect for a bit of lockdown, really, isn't it? Now, you specialise in philosophy and technology. Tell us a little bit more about how these two disciplines overlap. And also, possibly add a little bit of your experience from UCL, which I find particularly fascinating.
Yes, so Satalia was a spin-out of UCL, and I actually still have a relationship with UCL. So
if anyone's unclear, UCL is University College London, one of the big universities down there.
That's right. It's one of the biggest universities in Europe, and actually one of the most well-respected universities in the world around artificial intelligence. So it's the same university that DeepMind spun out of, and Satalia as well. And I still have a relationship with UCL, actually, where I for the past 4 years have run a master's program in business analytics, essentially applied AI. I had 50 students out every single year that were going out there applying emerging technologies to solving problems across a whole range of different industries. So it really gave me a sense of where companies are at in terms of their digital journey. My role in UCL is to help figure out how to take bleeding edge technology skills, the academics, and figure out how do they have a positive impact on the world. So I'm currently entrepreneur in residence for computer science. Access at UCL gives me access to philosophers and psychologists and all of this kind of stuff to make sure that when we're building solutions, we're not just building solutions from a technological perspective, but we're thinking about the ethics and the impact that these solutions will have on the workplace and on society.
Now, there are a lot of people who will probably, even though your brilliant descriptions about AI, I think, are spot on, that there's a lot of people thinking, oh, do you know what? It's all over my head. It's too complicated and it's a bit scary. And I guess that's because all the films about AI generally see AI as a negative thing. I mean, is there something to be concerned about? Is control of it and regulation of it important, or is that just a massive distraction?
As I said earlier, I think that technology is agnostic, and it can be used for things that are positive and can be used for things that are negative. I am hopeful about humanity, but I am also deeply concerned about the use of these technologies for things that I think have a negative impact on society. So I guess there are three things that I'm concerned about, and actually as part of Satalia's purpose is try to mitigate. So the first is, in some respects, the objective function, the goal of humanity, you could characterize as being to maximize GDP. That's primarily why we create infrastructure, why we create businesses, to create profit that allow organizations to contribute to government GDP. And my concern is that these technologies absolutely will accelerate that our ability to accumulate wealth and accumulate power. And if those countries are adopting those technologies first, they will probably win this battle. Unfortunately, win means that you will accumulate the wealth and power and other people will lose.
There has to be a loser, basically.
Indeed. And I think that this objective function that we currently have, this kind of, I guess, capitalistic model, means that these technologies are going to help us achieve that goal. But it means that there are people that are going to lose out. And so I think there are three things that I'm concerned about. The first is that we are going to be exceptional at profiling people, at selling stuff to people, even things that they don't need. And that is going to have a cost on our environment and the cost on people's well-being. The second thing I'm concerned about is that as we use these technologies to automate more and more tasks, at some point, these technologies will free people up from whole jobs. And if you're freed up from a job and you can't retrain fast enough because an AI has taken that job, then my concern is that we will see a huge amount of technological unemployment over the next couple of decades. Yeah. And I don't think our economies are set up to deal with that. And third and finally, there is a concern that as we're investing more and more in building intelligent machines, we are going to build within our lifetime a brain that is smarter than us in every single possible way. And this is the last invention that humanity will create. And nobody knows if it's going to be the most glorious thing that happens to us or our biggest existential threat. And my goal over the next 30 or 40 years is to figure out how do we get humanity cooperating so that if this thing does come along, it doesn't see us as a threat and remove us from the equation.
That sends shivers down your spine, doesn't it? But in reality, there are. Let's bring this back again, if you don't mind, to the food industry and issues around it. What AI is currently being applied to various situations and purposes in the food industry, and what can we ground ourselves with?
So again, let's go back to the kind of two areas that AI is being used. One is the recognition of objects and images, and in which case we can use those types of technologies to pack things more quickly, to identify the quality of goods, to be able to then have robots make decisions about where to put those goods. And then secondly, I guess, is the distribution of food. And I guess the manufacturing of food as well. So how can we use optimization techniques to make sure that we're getting the right nutrients to the right place? How to make sure that those goods are being farmed and they're being then distributed to people effectively? All of these problems that I've just described, again, are efficiency or optimization problems. And I think that, you know, we have a good understanding about how to solve them. There are technologies there that can make a real impact. The challenge is whether the industry or companies are able to invest in embracing these technologies. Where we're also seeing a little bit of an interesting shift is not in the application of these technologies to sell more stuff or to optimize our operations, but how can we actually use these technologies to reinvent how our organizations are operating? How can we use these technologies to redesign what it means to be an organization, to tap into gig workers, to tap into other types of models to enable organizations to be more adaptive to a changing world? So we're seeing AI is actually changing the nature and the structure of organizations, and I'm seeing that much more in industries like food than in professional services and those types of industries that have very, very high margins. So the industries that have very low margins, they're having to rethink their organizational models. They're having to change how they operate to be able to adapt more quickly to a changing world.
So, I mean, this is interesting, this in the investment concept. I mean, are you expensive? I mean, you know, you've got lots of coders, sort of beard wax that needs to be spent on various tools that out there. You know, is this a barrier to smaller companies tackling issues with AI?
It absolutely is, I think. And so, yes, you know, the people that we have in Satalia, we've got 120 people distributed across the world. These are not cheap people. And you also have to make sure that you provide environments for these people to thrive and be happy in. But as I said, we are trying to organize ourselves in actually radically new ways. So in Satalia, we don't have any hierarchies. We don't have any managers. We don't have any KPIs. We organize ourselves like a swarm. And And what that means is that we can be very efficient in terms of how we operate, which means our day rates are typically less than the other technology consultancies out there, even though they depend on us to solve really hard problems. But in reality, there still is a barrier, because day rates can be, you know, upwards of 700, 1,000 to £3,000 a day. And you're right, small companies with low margins, they can't afford that. Fortunately, Satalia doesn't have any venture capitalists, so we don't have any VC funding or people telling us how to operate and to hit certain KPIs and hit margins. So we're really free to organize ourselves how we want and work with clients who we want. And when I advise startups, I try to encourage them to avoid raising capital, because it will change the nature and culture of their organizations. But there are, because of COVID and because of this changing world, we do have to start to look at commercial models differently. And so there are opportunities to do gain share models, where there are opportunities to create and co-create IP to then take that to market. So I'm a really big advocate of actually making innovations free. I've suggested to Tesco that they open up their delivery solution and make it free to everybody, including their competitors. I can talk more about that later on. Well, like big organizations, you have shareholders to answer to. But my argument actually here is that if you are a company sitting on an innovation, let's say you've created a new manufacturing AI that's able to optimize your, I don't know, your warehouses efficiently. My argument is that for smaller companies, it's almost impossible for them to compete with big companies like Amazon and to be able to ultimately out-innovate them. Not because the Amazon's tech is better, but because Amazon have access to incredibly cheap capital. And ultimately, if large, very wealthy organizations want to go into a market, want to out-innovate you, they will in the long run. And my advice to companies now is, rather than you sitting on that innovation for the next 3 years, why don't you open it up, create a model that allows people to contribute to it and are paid for their contribution. And now what you have is an access to talent, and you have access to data. And I would argue that's way more valuable than the margin that you're going to extract from that innovation over the next 3 years. Because if you don't open it up, and if you don't own the data and own the community, then Amazon, Google, Facebook, they will. And ultimately, you're going to find it possible to be able to compete.
And so does that extend to sharing all of Satalia's algorithms and the open sourcing everything that you do?
Yeah, absolutely. My aspiration is to, in some respects, to remove the concept of a company. I think the idea of companies are a very silly construct, and in some respects, Satalia's success will be removing itself. But I'm the innovations that we build companies. Of course, we need to keep ourselves alive by profiting from them. But ultimately, what I want to do is I want to make our solutions available to the world. We are sitting on an incredibly powerful delivery logistics solution that could be used for hospitals and police across the world. And there's no point in a handful of companies just benefiting from that. And so what we want to do is we want to take these innovations, make them open, create economic models that enable people from around the world to be able to contribute to them through code and design or whatever, to be paid for that contribution, and to enable those innovations to be free for everybody to use.
You're a beautiful man. You're a beautiful man.
But
is this possible, you know, with when you're working with, certainly, I mean, my world is the food industry, which is a desperately profit-driven world where decisions are made, and again, you're talking about sort of low-margin, high volume operations where the wrong decision can be you know, crippling for a company. And is it feasible, do you think, to be able to open source everything?
I think it's not just feasible, it's critical. Because I think that companies now, they need to not just make profit, but they need to have an incredibly strong purpose. And if you don't have a strong purpose in terms of how you're contributing now positively to society, you are not going to ultimately, you're not going to attract customers, and you're not going to attract contributors, employees. And so I'm really trying to encourage companies to make sure that they have an intertwined profit purpose agenda, because that's the only way that they're going to survive. So ironically, I don't think that it's governments that are going to make the changes to make the world better. I think it's going to come from the private sector. And I want everybody to be holding leadership accountable and voting with their feet, working for the companies that are making a positive impact, and consuming also from companies that are making a positive impact.
Yeah, I completely agree, and I don't think that's sort of rabid capitalism. I think it's a very, very rational extension of it. We're drifting a little bit into ethics, and which is amazing. But I'd like to bring it back to some sort of current and relevant issues as well. The current situation where we are in lockdown at the moment, there's a huge amount of pressure being put onto retailers, and it seems to have exposed the sort of the just in time supply chain concept, and that there may be a lack of resilience there. What role can AI play in building resilience?
It's a great question, and I should say that that I have engaged with hundreds of CIOs over the past few years who are wanting to bring technologies into their organizations, particularly in retail, actually. And very recently, I've had a bit of a kind of a sobering moment. When I'm engaging with CIOs in retail organizations, I say to them, you know, what Satalia can offer in terms of our ability to combine machine learning with optimization, build adaptive systems, all of that good stuff. And they say, Daniel, why do we need you? We've got data scientists, we've got machine learning people, we've hired hundreds of them. And the sobering moment I've realized is that when I'm engaging with the CIOs, they don't realize that machine learning data scientists are really good at finding insights in data, but they are not good at solving optimization problems. And I keep repeating that because it's an important message. And so when you're thinking about just in time, when you're thinking about how to construct this, this is absolutely an optimization problem. So my concern is over the past year, CIOs, companies have been investing, they've been hiring the wrong people to solve problems that they don't understand. And I'm sorry to be so brutal about that, but it's like talking to a supply chain expert and then not knowing what a warehouse is. That's the kind of realization that I've had and that's because people have been seduced and duped by these AI, this AI buzzword. Machine learning is not AI, and companies have optimization problems.
Which brings us beautifully back to where we started, really. We really ought to wrap up now. I'm sure you're incredibly busy. Can we just have a look at the scope for AI in the future? I guess everyone's going to be asking this question to you all the time. What do you think the next areas, certainly of the food industry, if you don't mind, what are going to be the next areas that you think will benefit from AI?
Sure. I think that it's going to be relatively uninspiring in some respects. I think that there's going to be a realization that the investments that are currently being made are not driving the value that they expect. But we will start to see the combination of lots of different data sources coming together that allow us to find more interesting insights, to allow us to make better decisions. So we're going to see narrow AI, specific systems, being solving problems significantly better than what they were solved previously, and driving more efficiencies. I would like to see an opening up of data, and I would like to see an opening up of innovations to allow kind of external world to be able to help drive those innovations forward. And again, that will be powered by AI. So again, more around reinventing how the organization operates. We're going to see a lot more stuff around automation and robotics, and particularly robots doing things that traditionally were in the domain of human beings. But again, I would not get seduced or duped by that. At the core, you're going to see your most benefits by improving decision making.
Yeah. Okay, and just as one final question, what is your favorite use of AI? If you could be really specific, what is the one thing that maybe inspired you to be interested in it to begin with, or that you just think that's really cool? What's your best favorite use of artificial intelligence?
Well, it's not really a use, but when you start to think about AI and think about building machines that are conscious or sentient, it starts to question what is the meaning of life, what is consciousness, what are ethics, and what ethics should we be building into systems, what ethics should we be adhering to society, which is, I think, a topic that's really popular in the media right now, and it's why I think there's a lot of buzz around it, because it has brought to life and it's asking us now to face into some of these questions around who does the driverless car kill? Is it the kid or is it the two adults that are on the side of the road? And so for me, it's surfaced a lot of questions, ethical questions that philosophers have been pontificating for 3,000 years that we're now actually having to build into systems.
Mm. and makes us contemplate our mortality.
Indeed.
but absolutely perfect. Okay, Daniel, thank you so much for joining us. And I know that we're going to be looking at this area again and again. So hopefully you can come back to chat to us at another point. You've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast from Food Matters with David Hume, founder and CEO of Satalia, and me, Stefan Gates. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from salmon farm sustainability to gut health. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Goodbye.
You've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.